middle/high school class. Nathan Brooke are out of town, so welcome. And as always, we welcome any questions or comments. Week 5, it's in the middle of this, chapter 19 and 20. Is anybody need one from last week? Just have a couple extra. Well, the boys. Oh, yeah. So I have one. Here's, if you would, you and Brian. And previously, in 1 Kings, Elijah has been to Ahab to warn him about the drought. Sorry?
Is it week 5?
Yes, sir, week 5. Previously, again, Elijah's been to Ahab, king of Israel, to warn him about the drought. And again, this is based on them not following God, him taking away the rain. Elijah is told to travel. He goes to Zarephath of Sidon, stays with a Gentile widow. And Tom even mentioned this on the Lord's Day in his sermon. He heals her son, and Elijah challenges Ahab and the followers of Baal to a challenge at Mount Carmel to prove who is the true and living God. Of course, we know the one true living God prevails and is shown. From that point, Elijah prays to God. The rain returns after 3.5-year drought. Bringing us to chapter 19, where we have a kind of a twist of events. Elijah hides from Jezebel. She finds out, verse 1, what Elijah has done to the prophets of Baal. He's killed them. She finds out, threatens Elijah with his life. Verse 2, sends a messenger to him that within 24 hours she's going to do the same to him as he's done to the prophets of Baal. Verse 3, he's afraid, runs for his life. He goes to Beersheba, which is pretty much, as we said before in the maps, that's pretty much the most southern point that you can go to within the region of Judah, still being in Palestine. But then he still, well, later, let's see, it's not just yet. Not just yet, he goes, but no, it does, verse 4. He does still travel another day's journey beyond Beersheba into the wilderness. Finds a juniper tree, which is same as a broom tree, whatever that may be. Sits under it and begins to pray to God that he may die. He thinks his life's over, done with. He's done enough that Jezebel's threatened his life. Yet he's had such faith to this point. It's kind of ironic that he doesn't stand up to Jezebel. That's just a point of thought. And he takes her threat and goes with it and leaves. Nonetheless, makes us wonder, at what point do we determine that we're done, that we're finished? Another oddity that Elijah prays that it's done, it's over. But verse 5, it picks up that an angel wakes him up as he's under this tree. It tells him to get up, eat, and drink. And as he looks around, there's bread and water. And then this happens a second time in verse 7. An angel tells him to do that again, because the journey is too great for him. He's being prepared for a trip. Elijah had to prepare for what God had planned for him, not what Elijah thought God had planned per se, because Elijah thought it was done. He was pretty much ready to die. Verse 8, after eating the two meals, he travels 40 days and nights on the strength he got from the food. And in verse 6, it tells us it was bread, cake, and a jar of water, as I'd mentioned. He travels to Horeb, which is Mount Sinai, which we're very familiar with. And we'll pick up at verse 9. Let me read 9 through 14, if you would. 1 Kings 19. Picking up at verse 9. This is after he's traveled to Mount Sinai. Then he came there to a cave and lodged there. And behold, the word of the Lord came to him, and he said to him, "What are you doing here, Elijah?" He said, "I've been very zealous for the Lord, the God of hosts, for the sons of Israel have forsaken your covenant, torn down your altars, and killed your prophets with the sword, and I alone am left. And they seek my life to take it away." So he said, "Go forth and stand in the mountain before the Lord." And behold, the Lord was passing by, and a great and strong wind was rending the mountains and breaking in pieces the rocks before the Lord, but the Lord was not in the wind. And after the wind, an earthquake, but the Lord was not in the earthquake. After the earthquake, a fire, but the Lord was not in the fire. And after the fire, a sound of a gentle blowing. When Elijah heard it, he wrapped his face in his mantle and went out and stood in the entrance of the cave. And behold, a voice came to him and said, "What are you doing here, Elijah?" Then he said, "I've been very zealous for the Lord, the God of hosts, for the sons of Israel have forsaken your covenant, torn down your altars, and killed your prophets with the sword, and I alone am left, and they seek my life to take it away." He's repeating himself as if God didn't hear him, but he knows God heard him. The Lord said to him, "Go, return your way to the wilderness of Damascus, and when you have arrived, you shall anoint Hazael king over Aram, Jehu the son of Nimshi, you shall anoint king over Israel, and Elisha the son of Shaphat of Abel-Meholah, you shall anoint to be prophet in your place." So he's instructed what to do. Anoint these two as kings, and Elisha to replace him as prophet. Verses 19 through 21, Elijah leaves to go find Elisha. And I need to apologize ahead of time. I may mix the two names up since they're very similar. And if I do, bear with me. But nonetheless, Elijah goes to find him, finds Elisha plowing with 12 pairs of oxen. And when he gets near to him, he throws his mantle around Elisha. And a mantle, by definition, is a square piece of cloth, usually used as a cloak, and sometimes when it's cold, as a blanket. So it doesn't indicate the size of it, but it's used as a wrap, kind of an outer garment, and that appears to be the mantle he threw onto Elisha as he got near. And this mantle is going to play a part later on that we'll see that will do some unusual things. Verse 20, Elisha goes and tells his parents goodbye. He first asks Elijah if it's okay, and Elijah says to do so. And Elisha, again, tells his parents goodbye, takes two of the oxen, prepares them in a sacrifice, gave them to the people to eat. It's kind of like a farewell celebration he has for the family. Then he leaves all to follow and minister to Elijah. Verses 19 through 21. Any questions or comments? Pretty quickly gets us through chapter 19.
Well, it's a big change of this experience of Elijah at Mount Sinai and Moses at Mount Sinai. You know, all the very things that, you know, the earthquake and the wind and the fire, those were all things that were present at Sinai when the law was given. And the God is showing that he's not necessarily always manifest himself in that way.
You know, in an earth-shattering way.
Small ways too. Even if he was the only one left, if God is still working through him, what difference does that make? Is God limited because he only has Elijah to work with? Of course, it turns out that Elijah is just shows his ignorance because he doesn't know how many people are out there that are serving the Lord.
Yeah.
And I think that's a valuable lesson for us because I think one of the big failings a lot of Christians do is, you know, your preachers say all the time, this is the only faithful church in this town. Well, how do you know that? You know, or there are only, you know, so many preachers in this state or something. You don't know any of that because only God knows. And that's the thing we have to keep remembering. And when we start trying to quantify things like Elijah, that's when we get all depressed and we think it's all about us. And we forget that God is acting according to his purpose.
He's in charge.
He doesn't even need us.
That seems to be the attitude that he's just like giving up and just not seeing or not even looking that God has a plan for him. Very unusual. Just a second, then Shane first. Yes.
I find it interesting throughout the Bible here when he's being fed by the angel we don't know, whether the actual cake that he ate, whether there was something miraculous about that, particular food, it was able to sustain him for 40 days, but, was that the actual cake that sustained him because it was miraculous properties to it, or whether it was just God doing that. But you think about it, as a God didn't need to have him, eating anything if he wanted to. You know, he could have just
said go.
Him and said to go, but it's just interesting how throughout the Bible, and even Jesus, when Jesus was performing miracles and things, there's so many times when things are being done that whatever man is capable of doing, he's required to do. When they're performing some of these miracles, you know, he had to participate. He had to eat the food. When Jesus turned water into wine, they had to physically fill the things up with water first, and then carry them. And as they carried them, they became wine. And just different things that it's not just him performing some miracle, but man is always required to do something. And I think we can extrapolate a little bit of that into our daily lives, that we don't just sit and wait for something to happen. That if we're capable of doing something, I think God expects us to meet him partway and put effort into things if it's something that we want him to help us with.
Good point. Some effort has to be put forth before something may happen. Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Travis.
I think this is a particularly encouraging chapter, at least for me. We see all through the Old Testament, God, at least in general, with these people, tends to be, he's very firm. And we just saw it in Mount Carmel where he's so, the fire of God comes down. Here we have Elijah maybe getting a little discouraged, and we don't see God, maybe we might think, come back and say, come on now, get up, you're not done. We don't see God do anything like that. And instead, through this whole chapter, we get a very comforting image of God, where I think part of that may be him offering this food, and he didn't have to do that, but it's almost like he's doing this as a means to kind of, lift Elijah's chin a little bit and say, come on now, you're...
Who's taking care of you?
Exactly.
God is still taking care of you.
It's a very encouraging image where Elijah, we can apply it to ourselves. He thought he was alone. He wasn't alone. And we have this God who's in the gentle dwelling. He's not always this wrathful God when we're doing what he wants us to do.
Exactly. Reminds us that even as Tom said, they weren't supposed to touch the mountain or, even ascend the mountain when God was on Mount Sinai. It was just very powerful, but yet he's not manifesting himself at this point that way. So very good points. Yes, sir.
I think this is a case where a prophet was burned out and God took him, replaced him.
Well, that's what it seemed like at the very end after he said to anoint these two as kings. Then he says, and go get your replacement. Is what it kind of sounds like, right? So it's kind of like saying, well, yes, if you think you're done, then we'll go find Elisha to replace you. So, yes, sir.
Now, the other intriguing thing in the story is how God uses Elijah to anoint a king of a pagan nation. And it's a reminder of those other occasions that prophets were sent to prophesy to Gentile nations. And it reminds us God's a God of all the earth and not just Israel.
So, true. God of all nations. He places all kings and those in authority in place. He places them there. Chapter 20. We pick up with Ben-Hadad, and just mentioned Elijah going to anoint the king of Aram. But at this point, Ben-Hadad is king of Aram, Arameans, and he goes to besiege Samaria, verse 1. Takes his army. He's got the help of 32 kings, so he's amassed quite a following. He's got horses and chariots. Verse 2, he sends messengers into Samaria to King Ahab and tells him that he wants the gold, the silver, his most beautiful wives, and his children to be given to Ben-Hadad. Now, this is the same Ben-Hadad that when he threatened, or that's the one that Asa had sent the items out of the temple back in chapter 15, 18, when it was Baasha. I don't have it in front of it. Asa was being threatened by the king of Israel. So he asked Ben-Hadad's help, and he sends these items to him. So it's not been very long since this has happened. So Ben-Hadad may be catching on that, look, I can just ask for this gold and silver out of the temple. And it must have been time enough that Ahab's built these items back up in the temple, and they're available. So nonetheless, Ben-Hadad is asking for these things from King Ahab. Verse 4, Ahab responds, "You're right," he said. "O king, I'm yours and all that I have." So far he's agreeing to Ben-Hadad's request. Verse 5, messengers tell Ben-Hadad and then return to Ahab with a different message. It's changed now, the request. Ben-Hadad now says, not only do I want the things out of the temple, your most beautiful wives and also your children, but I'm also going to search through the king's palace and the servants' palace, or the servants' houses, and whatever we find desirable, we want to take also among everything else. Verse 7, Ahab calls together the elders to decide what to do with this request. And verse 9, they request him to turn this one down and go with the first request, but not the second. And in verse 10, Ben-Hadad's reply, is there enough dust for all of our soldiers to each pick up a handful? What he's trying to say, as it seems, is that I have such a large following that there may not be enough dust in Samaria for all of my soldiers, of these, his following and his 32 kings and their soldiers, to pick up enough dust. So he's kind of threatening, by the size of the army that he's got, to kind of take care of Ahab very easily. But guess what? Verse 11, Ahab turns around and warns Ben-Hadad that he shouldn't boast about the victory before the victory. Kind of unusual, but Ahab stood up to him. Verse 12, Ben-Hadad didn't like the response. So he gathers his armies and stations them around Samaria. But in the meantime, verse 13, a prophet comes to Ahab and tells him that God's going to allow Ahab to have a victory, even as wicked as he's been. He's still going to allow Ahab to have a victory to prove that he is the true God. Verse 14, the prophet tells Ahab that the young men of the provinces will lead the battle. And that's going to be their way to win. Verse 16, the Israelite men leave Samaria at noon while Ben-Hadad was drinking with the other 32 kings, and it said he was drinking himself drunk. Verse 17, Ben-Hadad gets word of the battle that these men, what it appears to have been was that the young men were going to lead the army and kind of draw the army out. Then the rest of the army would ensue them and kind of overtake them, because Ben-Hadad had told his men to take them alive, not to kill them. And that allowed the Israelite soldiers to follow and to defeat the Arameans. But nonetheless, verse 17, Ben-Hadad gets word of the battle. He, as I said, verse 18, tells his men to take these Israelite men that are leading the battle alive. In verse 20 and 21, it allows the Israelites God's help, of course. And God had already told them that they would defeat. And they did defeat the Arameans with a great slaughter. Ben-Hadad escaped on a horse and with horsemen. But, verse 22, the same prophet that had gone to him before to tell him that they would win comes back to Ahab and says, at the beginning of the new year, Ben-Hadad's going to return for another battle. So Ahab knows Ben-Hadad's going to return for vengeance, you might say. So verse 23, Ben-Hadad's servants come to him and tell him, give him a plan, and say that they figured out why the Arameans lost the battle. They said the gods of Israel are gods of the mountains, and they're stronger, and that's where the battle took place, and that's why we lost. So, if we draw these Israelites into the plains, into the valleys, our gods are stronger in the valleys. So we should overtake these Israelites, and that's their plan, and they convince Ben-Hadad of this. In verse 24, he's changed his plan to have the captains lead the armies instead of the kings into this battle. He still builds his, this has been Ben-Hadad, builds his armies up, same number of horses, same number of chariots, same number of men. And again, taking the battle to the plain, to the valley, surely, verse 25, they believe they're going to be stronger. Continuing in these verses, verse 26, same time next year, as the prophet had said, Ben-Hadad brings his armies down to the valley, that valley of Aphek, to have the battle with Israel. Verse 27, the Israelites were like two little flocks of goats compared to the vast army of the Arameans. Again, huge army, as we see the 32 kings that included with Ben-Hadad. Let me read verse 28. The prophet comes to Ahab. This is chapter 20, verse 28. Then a man of God came near and spoke to the king of Israel and said, "Thus says the Lord, because the Arameans have said, 'The Lord is a God of the mountains, but He is not a God of the valleys,' therefore I will give all this great multitude into your hand, and you shall know that I am the Lord." Again, the prophet comes to Ahab and says, "You're going to win again, even through all this evil, this idolatry, not being righteous. He and his army are going to defeat the Arameans again." Verse 29, as they were camping against each other, and finally on the seventh day, they joined into a large battle. And the Israelites killed 100,000 Arameans or foot soldiers in one day. The remainder of the Arameans, or some of them, verse 30, fled into the city of Aphek, and a wall fell on them, and 27,000 died there. Ben-Hadad seeks refuge in the city of Aphek in an inner chamber. And his servants convince him that if he'll put sackcloth on, a rope around his head, and ask for mercy of Ahab, that Ahab may spare his life. Verse 34, Ben-Hadad is brought before Ahab. Ben-Hadad tells him, just as we had mentioned, that he'll return all the cities that his dad had taken, his father had taken. He's going to return them to Ahab. They made a covenant. Ahab lets Ben-Hadad go. At this point, everything looks good. They were promised to win the victory, and they did. They beat the Arameans. But we pick up 35 through 43 that it was actually a mistake of Ahab. Why was that? Well, we have an unusual story, which this prophet is trying to reenact and get the point across that God actually wanted him to kill Ben-Hadad and utterly destroy him. There's a prophet that says to a gentleman there, a person, just picks out a person and says, "Please strike me." The man doesn't, and a lion kills him. He says it again to another person. Well, this person actually strikes him in verse 35 through 37. Verse 38, the prophet goes to Ahab, disguised, to react, to recount this story, to make the point across to Ahab that he was supposed to have killed Ben-Hadad. And then verse 42, he reveals himself and tells Ahab what he has done wrong. And that leads us to 42 and 43 at the end of the chapter. End of chapter 20. And he said to him, this is the prophet saying to Ahab, "Thus says the Lord, because you have let go out of your hand the man whom I had devoted to destruction, therefore your life shall go for his life, and your people for his people." So the king of Israel went to his house, sullen and vexed, and came to Samaria. So, he is going to die. He is going to suffer consequences for his idolatry to this point, plus having let Ben-Hadad go. And we're going to see in chapter 21 that he even shows more remorse and sorrow for the consequences which he's going to suffer for the idolatry. And God actually recognizes it later. He doesn't show much here. He is, it says, verse 43, went to his house sullen and vexed. Any questions or comments? That leads us to week 6, which we should have picked up today. Yes, sir. Go ahead.
I find it interesting that despite the fact that Ahab had come from an evil lineage, that God was willing to fight
defeat
the Syrians. Of course, because, as you said, they boasted that he was not the God really. Mm-hmm. He was only the God of the hills.
Yes. Limiting. Valleys. Yes.
But that God brought about this Syrians, despite the fact that Ahab was an evil person.
Yes, that's...
So it was done not for his sake, but it was done for the sake of the nation, and for the sake of God.
And to show the Arameans, too, that he was in charge and he was in control, exactly. And it happened twice. So it was very unusual that it happened, yes. As evil as Ahab was. Because it did say later in the chapter that, or another chapter, that he was the most evil of all kings to that point. Chapter 21. This one we've... Well, you need one. Naboth's Vineyard. All right. Still talking about Ahab. As we've mentioned before, that it slowed down. It was going quite quickly on this king did this, accomplished this, next king did this. But now we've slowed down to talk about Ahab for quite a while, Elijah and so forth. Still talking about Ahab. This time in Jezreel of Samaria, adjacent to the palace of Ahab, was this nice vineyard, and Naboth owned it. Ahab wanted it, but even up to this point, he's seen the power of God. He's seen what God can do. Mount Carmel, as we just mentioned, and the rain after the drought, twice had delivered Ahab from destruction by Ben-Hadad. But nonetheless, he still wants his vineyard. Verse 2, he has to have it. So he offers Naboth a better vineyard, or to pay for it. In verse 3, Naboth tells Ahab that he will not sell it or trade it. And he even tells why. And we can go back to Leviticus 25 and verse 23. And I've got a passage in Numbers also as to why Naboth will not part with his inheritance. But Leviticus 25 verse 23. Verse 20 says, "The land, moreover, shall not be sold permanently, for the land is mine, for you are but aliens and sojourners with me." So the inheritance they were having through the family was not to be parted with, was not to be sold. Numbers 36 and verse 7. Numbers 36 verse 7. "Thus no inheritance of the sons of Israel shall be transferred from tribe to tribe, for the sons of Israel shall each hold to the inheritance of the tribe of his fathers." Naboth tried to explain this to Ahab, that he wasn't wanting to part with it, not because of Ahab, but because he felt like he wasn't supposed to keep it in the family. Ahab doesn't like this answer. He wants this vineyard. Goes back to his palace, sad, sulking, lays down on his bed, turns his face away from anyone entering the room, and doesn't eat. It doesn't take long, verse 5, for Jezebel to figure out something's wrong, so she asks Ahab. Ahab tells her what's wrong, that he wants this vineyard, but Naboth will not part with it. But does he tell her the whole story? Did anybody catch that? Or
she wouldn't know the...
About the law.
About the law.
That's true, that's true. But nonetheless, he just tells her what's happened. He didn't explain that Naboth, anyway, that he doesn't want to part with it because he doesn't want to lose his inheritance. He wants to keep it in the family. Nonetheless, verse 7, Jezebel very confidently reminds Ahab that he's king. Can't you get what you want? Can't you do what you want as king? Pretty much. She tells him she will get the vineyard for him. "Don't worry, I'll get it for you." Verse 7. So, verse 8, Jezebel comes up with a plan and writes this plan or instructions down in letters, puts Ahab's name and seal on it as if it was coming from Ahab, but actually it's Jezebel coming up with all this. And she sends these letters out. Of course, we remember what's in those letters. Verse 9 and 10, the instructions were to announce that they're to have a fast, to gather the people together, send an invitation to Naboth, put him at the front of the table or front of the gathering with two worthless men who are going to falsely accuse and testify that they've heard Naboth curse God and the king. According to Leviticus 24 verses 15 and 16, this is, if you're accused of this and you have witnesses, then you can be stoned to death. You can be put to death for cursing God. So according to the old law, this can be done if they can prove it. So verse 11 through 13, the men follow Jezebel's directions. They get this gathering together, proclaim the fast. Naboth is accused falsely, of course, and they follow through. They take him outside of the city and stone him to death. Verse 14, word is sent to Jezebel that her plan worked. Naboth is now dead. As we look at verse 15 and 16, let me read that for you. Chapter 21, verse 15 and 16. When Jezebel heard that Naboth had been stoned and was dead, Jezebel said to Ahab, "Arise, take possession of the vineyard of Naboth, the Jezreelite, which he refused to give you for money. For Naboth is not alive, but dead." When Ahab heard that Naboth was dead, Ahab arose to go down to the vineyard of Naboth, the Jezreelite, to take possession of it. Any word of conscience or concern or hurt feelings or feeling bad about it? No. Yes, sir?
And it doesn't seem like any of Naboth's family stood up for it, as their inheritance either. Everybody was like,
"Who's the king?" And it seemed, well, we don't know how quickly it took place, but it seemed like it was very rushed that they took the words of these worthless men, took him out, stoned him. And she may have rushed, Jezebel may have had it rushed along where there's not much recourse or not much, hey, he needs a fair trial here. And yes, you're absolutely right. It was done seemingly very quickly and carried out very quickly. And Jezebel's making the point that the king can pretty much have whatever he wants, even if it's wrong or done wrongfully, and it's carried out. Yes, sir? And we know that witnesses had to corroborate for it to be substantiated for something to take place. Like when Christ was on trial, the false witnesses never corroborated. The testimony never fit, never matched against Christ. But in this case, it worked against killing Naboth. Evidently so. Evidently. So they didn't try to stop it, as Barry was saying. Not trying to stop it, unfortunately. They could have very well been in it, knowing that Ahab wanted this vineyard pretty bad. Whew. Nonetheless, no seeming conscience or being hurt. Nonetheless, verse 17, the word of the Lord comes to Elijah. Elijah goes to meet Ahab in Samaria in the very vineyard as Ahab is there the previous vineyard of Naboth. Verse 19 through 24. As we look at that, Ahab still regards Elijah as the enemy, the prophet as the enemy. Yet, as we look at it, the prophet is a spokesperson for God, for telling God's word, or the future, for the most part, just telling God's word, sharing it with mankind. And Ahab's not accepting it. Ahab's just, it's as if he doesn't want truth. And he's that corrupt, not willing to accept it. Same with us sometimes. We ever think of a preacher being the enemy or the sermon being preached at us, well, maybe we're doing something wrong. Likewise with the police. Are we supposed to be afraid of the police? Not if you're doing right. Not if you're doing what's right. As we know in Romans 13 and 2 Timothy 4, that if we do what's right, we shouldn't be afraid of authority. But for some reason, Ahab is always at odds with Elijah and not accepting him. Not accepting his word. Verse 21 through 24, we have the consequences of Ahab and Jezebel because of their idolatry, their evil. And as I said before, verse 25, there had been no one more evil than Ahab up to this point. And even Jezebel gets her two cents because of Jezebel inciting Ahab. And inciting means encouraging, persuading, instigating, initiating. So, nonetheless, she's given credit for a lot of his evil, that Ahab has allowed the idolatry. And we know that she, likewise, was very evil and, as God pointed out, very corrupt, even through the government. Has a lot of power. Verse 26, Ahab had followed the idolatry of the Amorites, and we know also that of the Sidonians, where Jezebel was from. Very evil. After the consequences are handed down as far as what's going to happen, let me read that to you because it's very graphic as far as what's going to happen to in verse 21 through 24. Let me look at that. "Behold, I will bring evil upon you and will utterly sweep you away and will cut off from Ahab every male, both bond and free in Israel. I will make your house like the house of Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, and like the house of Baasha, the son of Ahijah, because of the provocation with which you have provoked me to anger and because you have made Israel sin." We recall those two families were allowed to be utterly destroyed because of their allowing idolatry and not doing anything about it. "Of Jezebel also has the Lord spoken, saying, 'The dogs will eat Jezebel in the district of Jezreel. The one belonging to Ahab who dies in the city, the dogs will eat. And the one who dies in the field, the birds of heaven will eat. Surely there was no one like Ahab who sold himself to do evil in the sight of the Lord because Jezebel, his wife, incited him.'" So nonetheless, consequences of their idolatry, very graphic, and we know these come to take place in the next few chapters. Both Ahab and eventually Jezebel dying also. But believe it or not, verse 27 through 29, as we're wrapping up, Ahab repents. He tears his clothes, puts on sackcloth, he fasts. He went about despondently and softly. In verse 28 and 29, the Lord sees this and tells Elijah, "Have you seen how Ahab has humbled himself?" When he finally realizes what evil he has done. And since Ahab humbled himself the way he did, God said in verse 20 through 24 that he's going to carry out this death sentence later in the days of his sons, or in his sons' days. So he's going to prolong or put off this a little while. We have a few more minutes. Chapter 22, let's see how far we get. Verses 1 through 36, battle with Arameans again. There had been, verse 1, there had been peace for about 3 years. But Ahab, king of Israel, reminds his servants that Ramoth-Gilead had belonged to Israel, but it was still being controlled by Arameans. And we remember back in 20, verse 34, that Ben-Hadad said that with his covenant, he was going to give back all these cities. It may have been one of those. Ahab said it hadn't taken place. So in verse 2, he asked Jehoshaphat, king of Judah, who happened to come down to meet Ahab, asked him if he'll join him and help him to battle the Arameans and take back this city. Jehoshaphat agrees. Verse 5, Jehoshaphat says, though, we need to ask the Lord first. Is this the right thing to do? Should we be doing this? And again, that brings another thought that how often had Ahab asked God's request? He was at odds with Elijah, so he wasn't used to asking for permission or asking, should I do this, should I not do this? This is where some unusual things are going to take place. A deceiving spirit is going to come through. It's going to be shown that these two kings are going to be told one thing, and that's to lead them into battle, but they're not supposed to be going to battle. So it's kind of unusual. And it's for a reason. Ahab is going to die in the battle. So I'll let the cat out of the bag. Nonetheless, verse 6, we'll go back to verse 5. Jehoshaphat says, let's ask the Lord. Verse 6, Ahab gathers about 400 prophets and asks them, what should we do? Should we go to battle or not? They say yes. All these 400 prophets all agree. Yes, let's go to battle. The Lord will deliver us, will deliver you and Ramoth-Gilead to you. But as we see, as we jump ahead to verse 21 through 23, this is a deceiving spirit to give them the wrong answer so that they will go to battle and be defeated. Verse 7, Jehoshaphat didn't like the group of prophets' answer. So he asked, is there anyone else? Verse 8, Ahab says, he didn't want to suggest Elijah. He didn't like Elijah, of course. But he mentions Micaiah, the son of Imlah, as the prophet to ask what we should do. So Jehoshaphat says, let not the king say so, because he was still bad-mouthing Elijah. Elijah was not saying the answers that Ahab wanted to hear. So that's kind of a lesson there. Y'all go ahead and come in. Even though Elijah spoke truth, Ahab didn't always want to hear that answer. just like with Naboth. He didn't want to hear no, he wanted the vineyard. So it's kind of odd. Do you want to know whether you're going into battle or not? But yet, he's not willing to hear the right answer. Very unusual. So let's see where we got to. So let's pick up with verse 9. Ahab's going to send for Micaiah. That's at the top. Okay. All right. And that's at the toward the 21, 22. So right in the middle of our second sheet again. So we're not quite caught up, but we'll pick up with verse 9 of chapter 22. Again, thank you for your questions and comments.